Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Armour, today joined by Ricardo Teixeira. Well, we have some exciting stories today and horrifying stories, quite frankly. And let's start off with our first one. Reporting has emerged that China and South Africa have apparently signed some sort of secret 500 million rand revamp to one of South Africa's military bases. Now, some kind of military partnership with another country is definitely not an unheard of thing, right? And it's not necessarily a bad thing, although in the case of China, I think it probably is. But regardless of whether we should be signing agreements with the Chinese government or not, what's really horrifying about this one is that it seems to be entirely buried in a cloud of secrecy. Not even Parliament has been properly informed about what's going on. So according to reporting in Report, and the City Press, the Defense Forces, South African Defense Forces Mobilization Center at De Burg outside Bloemfontein will be revamped with Chinese technicians for about to the tune of about 500 million rand. The cost of the upgrade will apparently largely be borne by China. The Chinese will carry out the upgrade with their own technicians and are currently in the design phase of the project. The Defense Forces labeled the whole project as classified and highly secret ahead of the announcement. The thing is being called Project, I think it's Xingza. I'm not entirely sure how to. And it only came to light when it was mentioned in passing during a discussion of the Defense Forces annual report for the Parliamentary Joint Standing Committee on Defense. Further investigative work by Report and the DA spokesperson on defense, Chris Hutting. No relation to our regular guest, Chris Hutting, said that they had signed this agreement in Beijing last year, and exactly what the assistance entailed was never explained by the military until the project suddenly surfaced. Chris Hutting from the DA said, Angie Motleka must explain why the Chinese military has access to strategic military infrastructure and possibly sensitive naval vessels without national security risks having been taken into account. The package also apparently includes certain repair and maintenance work on some of the Navy's vessels and facilities. It's, according to Hutting, unheard of for such projects to be shielded behind clandestine classification, and this is a direct assault on the country's sovereignty. This is extremely suspicious, Ricardo. Like,
yeah, this is top
secret. What the hell is going on here?
In my opinion, this is probably one of the biggest threats to our sovereignty in my living memory. If any foreign country obtains operational control, oversight, or influence over a base, or any access bypass to that base that bypasses the oversight of the of Parliament and any civilian control to that base, that is a violation of our territorial integrity. Right? The fact that this is lack transparency, there's been no democratic oversight. Parliament has had absolutely no clue that this was happening until it was briefly mentioned, and there's been no legislative approval. That raises some serious concerns about accountability, and you know that is a sovereign duty of the government. That in a decision that was made when we drafted the Constitution and the Defense Act of 2002 for the Defense Forces, that they would be accountable to civilian oversight. This seems to have all fallen by the wayside. And I mean, I have some contacts that are currently stationed at, and it's De Burg, by the way, not De Burg, De Burg Mobilization Center. 500 million would get you a lot. You know, there isn't a lot of infrastructure at the base. Most of it is warehouses for storage that could use some maintenance and some upgrades and repairs. But that's going to cost you 50 to 100 million. If you're spending 500 million on the space, you are adding something. So if they were to add something like a runway or storage depots that have their own access for Chinese personnel and are not accessible by SANDF personnel, that is a massive violation of our sovereignty and of our constitution and the Defense Act. This is something that, you know, people, I put up a thread about this on Twitter where I showed some images of the base and people said, oh, you'd be okay if America did this. No, no one should be doing this. We have never allowed a foreign country, regardless of whether it's East or West, to have had access to our military bases to such an extent. And we should never do this.
Yeah, much less, as you say, without sort of the public being informed of this. This is a really serious decision. It amounts to, I mean, you know, who are they building that infrastructure for? Are they building it for us? Or is China doing it with, you know, aims that they're going to use it at some point? In which case, have we been signed up for something that we have no idea what our military has agreed to behind closed doors?
This doesn't exactly sound like non-aligned to me.
No, don't worry, guys. We're non-aligned. We're just going to go and have a naval exercise with Russia and China off our coast. But don't worry, America, we're non-aligned. You know, like, at least if you know, you had this thing out in the open, it could be critiqued properly. But this is just bonkers stuff. And the fact that it's all being done by Chinese technicians, too, kind of makes you wonder, well, you know, why is that? Is that because we lack the skills? I mean, maybe we do. So, but this is it because they're designing it for their own purposes? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's not an investment. Like, if we were to do the upgrades ourselves to the base, that would be 500 million rand that would go to South African companies, that would pay South African salaries, and would buy South African materials. So that money would go back into the economy. A lot of it would be recouped on taxes, but it would be predominantly all spent locally. But the fact that China's footing the bill means none of that money is coming into our economy. That is just the value of resources that they are putting in that we are not going to keep. And again, with the design phase, we don't know what they're designing. We don't know. I mean, there's a lot of space at the Brug. You could add, you know, an airstrip. You could add some hangars, because that currently it's something that it lacks. If you want to upgrade the warehouses, are you adding more warehouses? It's all your own equipment. I don't see China spending 500 million rand on warehousing for us to store stuff there.
Yeah, and your mind begins to wonder then. You start to think, well, okay, let's assume the possibility exists in the next few years that a conflict might break out between America and China over the sovereignty of Taiwan. And in such a circumstance, well, it turns out we have a base that suddenly just had, for example, a huge new runway built in the middle of our country that has Chinese military personnel on it. Are we supposed to believe that this is somehow going to just be completely ignored? I mean, this is exactly the kind of idiocy that would get us dragged into some foreign conflict.
The wrong side of
no
history.
Business or no interest. Yeah, never mind the fact that this is with an authoritarian regime that shares none of our democratic values, that basically you know, spits on the ideals of our constitution. All of that is like an afterthought to the fact that...
Don't worry about it. Don't ask questions. It's fine. China's our friend. China cares about us.
Yeah, look, having a trade relationship with China, sure, okay? It's a necessary thing, especially if you want to get economic growth to end poverty in this country. But man, this kind of stuff just stinks to high heaven. And you really have to begin to wonder whether, you know, you combine this with the fact that our defense leadership was off in Iran, talking about how we're on the same side as Iran, as to whether the military is essentially pursuing something like its own foreign policy here, which is just completely counter to the official statements of Durko. Or is this the authentic view of Durko, in which case, well,
there's a big mismatch.
Stop pretending that we can salvage the reputation with the Americans.
There's a big mismatch and miscommunication between Durko and Sandef. I know this has been very frustrating for members of the Defense Foreign Relations part of the Defense Force and the military attaché corps here in Pretoria, who I interact with on the regular. They really, like, there is a very, very big mismatch with talking with DFR at Sandef and talking with Durko, who are not talking to each other. They are not sharing a building. They do not have offices in close communication with each other. And it has proven to be very frustrating for Durko when you look at Sandef's underperformance and failures in the DRC, and then you try and match the rhetoric and the ambition of Durko with wanting to be a peaceful negotiator on the continent, and then we get our ass kicked in the DRC.
Yeah, just bonkers stuff. Okay, so from one bonkers story to another, there have been revelations of many horrifying kinds at the Matlanga Commission over the past couple of weeks. But one of the most recent is about the Ekurhuleni Metro Police Department. This is the Metro Cops for the East Rand. And it's been alleged by a senior member of the Ekurhuleni Metro Police, former deputy chief, Revo Spies, that the EMPD is basically filled
a gang
with convicted criminals. It's basically a gang. That one EMPD officer was convicted of his own wife's murder and had been reappointed after being released on parole, becoming one of 275 convicted criminals serving in the Metro Police. According to the evidence given by Spies at the Matlanga Commission on Tuesday, the EMPD's corporate and legal department had insisted officers who had been found to have criminal records during a later aborted vetting process could not be fired or face disciplinary action. Spies was talking about a conflict he had with the EMPD Deputy Chief Julius Mkwanazi, who I believe is of no relation to the more famous Mkwanazi. When the issue of fingerprinting and background checks on EMPD personnel was brought up, Brigadier Mkwanazi was sitting opposite me, and this is a quote from Spies, and he started to scream and even spit a froth that comes out of his mouth at me when he was screaming, extremely disrespectful towards me, screaming that he doesn't have a criminal record, and I'm saying that he's got a criminal record. And I said to him, look, I'm not saying he's got a criminal record. I'm giving feedback on the status of the fingerprints. What I do say is that your section didn't provide fingerprints, and they refused to provide the fingerprints. I'm not saying that you have a criminal record. And he just kept on screaming at me in front of all of us in the meeting. A different News 24 points out in a different investigation, they had found that infamous businessman and attempted murder accused Kat Matala had apparently been given essentially the rights to use blue lights in Ekurhuleni by Julius Mkwanazi. Man, Ricardo, where do we even start with this one?
Fun. So I just had to check some stats quickly. Now, this is a bit outdated, but in a 2007 publication from the Institute for Security Studies, they note that Ekurhuleni Metro Police Department had a component of 457 serving officers. Now, I don't know if it's much bigger since then, but we can say that more than 50% of the officers that are, if that number is still the same, have criminal records now. We don't know what the total complement is, but for that many in such a small department have criminal records is astounding. Right. It's almost more of a gang than
almost
anything.
Certainly higher than the general population, right?
Yeah, that is terrifying to consider that, you know, it's a city of about 2.4 million people. I don't know how much bigger it is now. We don't have the most up-to-date census, with the last one being flawed, but to have their Metro Police, in essence, be a gang that is divided and filled with people accused of rape and murder and armed robbery, that's quite an indictment for the public trust in
our
police.
Not just accused, convicted. Four PD officers have been convicted of murder, and four were found guilty of rape. 58 have been found guilty of assault, and 51 were convicted of theft. And you might say, if you were being very generous, undeservedly so, that, oh, well, you know, the Metro cops, they're not supposed to deal with major crimes. They're just supposed to deal with, you know, traffic infringements. It turns out a very significant number of the Metro cops have regular driving infringements. Under the influence.
Yeah. Oh, man. And it's shocking when we think of, like, this is supposed to be the, you know, to protect and serve. That's supposed to be what police officers do. And you and I were previously discussing this when with the Matlanga Commission and this ad hoc commission that all these findings came out. If you had to reform the police in South Africa, SAPS and the Metro Police, I think you'd have to go further than changing uniforms and changing badges and changing names. The public trust in these institutions has collapsed. I mean, SAPS has become synonymous with corruption. How far are we going to have to go to reform this?
Look, in my opinion, I think that while there are certainly still good cops in many places in the police, and you can, you know, if you talk to people who've done in reporting or worked with the cops, you will find that there are always officers who, despite everything, still stand kind of out from the crowd and do their jobs. But they are under siege, and they are not in control, unfortunately, it seems.
They are not in charge.
Yeah, they are not in charge. The entire police force has been at the top levels. It's been undermined by prioritizing political allegiance over merit. And we've seen this complete, as you say, this sort of evaporation of trust, of public trust in it. You probably need to create some sort of separate unit if you were looking to actually sort out the police, something like the Scorpions or maybe even something beyond the Scorpions, even bigger than them. To look at the cops and identify the worst offenders, identify those who are aligned to criminal gangs, identify those who are just complete non-performers, and get them out of the system.
A full skills and lifestyle audit.
Exactly, from sort of top to bottom, because the rot is just absolutely overwhelming. And until that's done, you're going to have very little power to do really anything in this country. Want to take on the construction mafias? Well, who are you going to use to do it? Want to take on, you know,
the gangs of the Western Cape?
Gangs in the Western Cape, you know, I don't know, MK having MK affiliated people deciding to set fire to a truck or something on the N3, the EFF deciding to Russia,
then we have to have that question.
Yeah, well, that's a different story. but it's just in general needing a full overhaul, and I think that that's the clear outcome of the Matlanga Commission so far.
Yeah. The police budget for this year has been 120 billion rand, and the police force exceeds 169,000 officers. So it's more than two times the size of the defense force, and it's got more than double the funding. And every year we see the police minister, whoever it is, sit before parliament and say, we don't have enough resources to do our job. We need more money. And the police budget goes up, but then most of the time so does the crime rate. And to me, when are we going to start asking the question that it looks more like we're funding crime than fighting crime? With everything coming out of the Matlanga Commission now, it's the reform of the police force. We're going to have to quite literally go back to the drawing board and start over from scratch.
Now, this is the unfortunate reality. And this is, I think, another place that devolution of various policing powers could come into play. It would create a space for different provinces to sort of do that process of starting from scratch and saying, okay, well,
you'd have to break them down individually,
exactly,
in per sector. Because if you try to, I mean, it's again, the easiest way to eat an elephant is one bite at a time. But you don't want to try and do it nationally in one go. So, yeah, to devolve it down to provinces and have each province do their own, while at the national level, you set up a new training school, new vetting process, and new mechanisms for recruitment and new management structures, so that when at the provincial level it's been cleaned up, you integrate it back into a national network that is managed nationally, but tasks are carried out at a provincial level, so that there are no national units, they're all provincial units. Because there also needs to be this question of, as Ian Cameron has brought up in the committee, of rural crime versus urban crime are completely different. So why are we using the same approach? Now, I favor the Portuguese model, where you take your investigative and your forensic capability and you put that directly under the Department of Justice, so that your investigators and your forensic officers work directly with your national prosecuting authority with the goal of successful prosecutions. And then you have your urban police and your rural police, where in the Portuguese model, they have more of a gendarme in the rural areas that also handle border security and airports and national roads and ports as well. And they're your officers that, you know, you don't work out of a station, you work out of your vehicle, and you cover a much larger geographic area. Whereas in an urban space, you work under your station and you work in a smaller confined urban space. And we could even look at the Japanese model of micro stations, where every 1.6 by 1.6 kilometer area has a police station with officers that only patrol that area, and they get to know that community and that population.
Yeah.
And you have more direct control over what's happening in that specific area. And if you also, I've got it here, the hotspot and murder policing for robbery in Cape Town, where, you know, if you look at this little, if I can get it to pick up here, this little area here, where do you put your hotspot, your small little micro police station? You know, you put it right there in the red dot, which happens to be, according to this map, is where two schools and a hospital are. So if that's where most of the murder and crime's happening, maybe that's also where a police station should be. You know, and there are so many different approaches we can take and so many different strategies that have been studied and proposed, but to put them all into place with the current structure is just, in my opinion, not going to be possible. We need to quite literally go back to the drawing board and rebuild the entire police force from scratch.
And that's kind of my hope for what will come out of the Matlanga Commission. Politically speaking, I don't think we're really going to see, you know, are lots of people going to go to jail and they're going to be thorough investigations? No, I don't think so. I think this is too tied up with politicians. Yeah. This is too tied up with, you know, the fact that the police, as we know, have all these weaknesses.
We need more prisons if we were going to do that.
Yeah, exactly right.
Where are we going to put
them? We don't have the space. But it's what I think it will do is it will build that appetite for that exact kind of reform in the public. I think a lot of South Africans who may not necessarily pay that much attention to the news every day will are getting the sense from the McLungan Commission, even if they don't always follow the details, that something is very, very wrong with the police. And, you know,
something is fundamentally wrong with our police force and our police service.
And this confirms what most people believe. I mean, the police is already one of the least trusted institutions in the country, continually scoring, I think, less than 30% sort of approval from South Africans. So that's what I hope comes out of it. And it's exactly these kind of ideas that need to be taken into account in order to actually turn things around, because right now it can't go on like this.
Yeah. And these were changes that you could argue should have been a lot more comprehensive when they were restructuring the police in 1994, but you know, they kept the same logo. They just put the word service on the end and changed the uniform slightly. And with the vehicles went from yellow and blue to white and blue. But fundamentally, the doctrine and the modus operandi for our police doesn't seem to have changed. And we've still got a police force that's orientation is to quell labor rebellions and to inflict violence on the population to put them in line. It doesn't, protect and serve doesn't seem to be the goal here. You know, what was that, the phrase that our police are very good at three things, skop, skid, and donor. And that's not what we need.
And that's exactly the problem. Is firstly, I mean, this is a democratic country now. That shouldn't be the police's relationship with the populace. But secondly, it hasn't worked. The only argument for a system like that is to say, okay, well, you need that to reduce crime. Well, it hasn't reduced crime because it doesn't actually solve our problems, and it's so badly managed. So I completely agree. And this is one of the great crises of South Africa. I mean, imagine how many social problems would be solved if we were able to cut our crime rate in half. The amount of sort of economic and human capital that is just destroyed continuously by crime,
and human potential.
Exactly. Middle-class people with skills going overseas because they're scared of crime. Young people who have ambitions to maybe escape poverty, having their lives cut short because they get caught in gang crossfire. The amount of money that has to be spent on private security just to protect people's stuff from being stolen. This is just constant, essentially burning of potential, burning of money, burning of resources that could be spent on so many much more positive things. So reforming the police, I think, is just something that we need to be talking more about than just in the vagaries of, oh, we will round up the criminals. Well, you know, you actually need a system that can do that properly.
And if you're going to round them up, then, you know, you also need to be able to successfully prosecute them and then correctly incarcerate them appropriately, you know, not overpopulate the prison. So there's a butterfly effect of all of these problems that, if we perhaps start with solving the crime issue and the policing issue, that maybe further down the line we solve some other issues. Maybe we don't have to build new prisons if the prisons are adequate and we successfully prosecute people and people are demotivated from committing crimes and the crime rate starts to go down. And we as well, with the drug issue, if we start treating drugs like a social issue instead of a criminal issue, and we start, you know, giving people addiction treatment rather than just locking them up, and we focus on the drug dealers, the downward effect on this is enormous. I think in closing that there needs to be a fundamental rethink on how we have a police service in South Africa. What model do we want to use? How do we want to implement it? And over what period of time are we willing to implement such steps? I mean, this is a massive issue. It's not going to be solved in a year or 2 years. This is something that's going to take 5 to 10 years to solve. But are we willing to go down that path? Are we willing to go through the effort for the South Africa we want and the South Africa we deserve? Or are we just going to continue dealing with this police force that and the police service that we have that has fundamentally failed us? This is something that hasn't changed in the last 31 years. And the downstream effect of crime and the failure of our policing has been enormous. Just look at the size of the private security industry, as you pointed out. I mean, it employs over 620,000 people. I mean, yes, those are jobs that we have, but and it's a very large part of the economy. But imagine if we didn't have to have that, if those people could have other jobs, right, and they could do other things.
It would be better for those jobs to be making things in factories or mining stuff out of the ground or working in offices or whatever. Whereas,
but the fact that every parking lot has to have a guy in it with a radio and a baton just to deter.
And you know, if you go and if you on Next, if you're a victim of crime and you have a private security company, and you're waiting for the cops, as I think it's a common experience with anyone who's experienced crime, talk to your private security guard, and ask them about how many colleagues they have had killed serving alongside them. It's horrific work.
Yeah, and ask them why they're not a police officer, why they decided to do private security. Because if you look at a lot of the armed response guys, there'll be former military or former police that have left at some point because they lost faith in the system. But imagine if we had those people still in the system, or we deputized them to a certain extent that they can arrest and legally arrest people and drop them off at a police station. How much easier that might be. I mean, again, 169,000 police officers, one of the largest police forces in the world. We spend 120 billion rand on our policing this year. That's, if I can just, I'm guessing out of my head here, but that's roughly 1.7% of GDP going towards policing. And this is what we get for it? We need to be asking some serious questions here.
Indeed. All right. So I think we've recovered from the technical problems I had there. But anyway, thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting. We will be back tomorrow with the Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day. Bye-bye. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.